Broadcasting live from the Annex Wealth Management Studios at The Avenue, it's time for Point Taken. Here are your hosts, Steve Scafidi and Kristen Bry.
Guess what day it is? Huh? Anybody? Julie, hey, guess what day it is? Oh, come on, I know you can hear me. Mike. What day is it, Mike? Leslie, guess what today is?
It's hump day.
Woo-hoo!
Ah, we celebrated. Indeed. We celebrated here on Point Taken. It is hump day.
It is hump day. It's like Jazz could read your mind to know to play that because you had already made the joke in the lead up during the commercial break. I was like, you know what day it is, right?
For me, it's a big day because, you know, my work week is intense. You know, I juggle a lot of different things as we go, as you do you. You're a young mom and you've got like 8 billion jobs. A lot of juggling. So when you get to Wednesday, and you get through that Wednesday, the hump, as they say, you're on your way to the weekend.
I know, but sometimes it's also anxiety fueled as far as like, oh, I have not gotten, especially in a week when you're sick like I am.
Yeah.
Like, I haven't gotten enough done this week. Like, I need more time.
You know, I have no power whatsoever at GKB and our WTMJ, but, you know, take a day off if you need to.
No, I know.
I took a day off
last week, so I feel.
Yeah.
I also like being here with you.
I don't know if you know this. I appreciate that. I don't know if you know. I could do a show by myself on a day.
Can you?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Could
absolutely.
You do that for a while?
I could, I think. Yeah. All right, so many things to talk about. We have a shortened show today.
You want to start with the new Marquette Law School poll.
Yes, I love it.
Why?
Because it gives us a sense. I'm a big, first of all, big fan of Charles Franklin.
No, same.
I mean, this
is nothing about their ability to poll well. It's just, is this the biggest story of the day?
In my mind, it is, because it gives me a sense of what the public is thinking. Now, I'm going to give you like the overview. Now, this is a national study on what people are thinking.
National poll.
Yeah, national poll.
But done by local pollsters.
But well-respected.
Yes.
Gold standard in the state and well-respected across the country. That's a given for me. And I know some people are like, oh, I don't trust polls. Get over yourself. Polls are a snapshot at a specific time of what the public is thinking, whether that's an election. In this case, it's sort of more across the president's job approval numbers. And number two, my big other big takeaway, the issues of the day, what people care about. Let's start with job approval. Donald Trump. None of this is surprising to me because we talk about the president and we talk about his performance. Net approval, his positives, not surprising. Border security, something he ran on, something he's certainly done a lot of in his first few months in office. Everything beyond that is in the negative, whether it's overall, minus 8. Foreign policy, minus 14. The economy, which I'll get to in a second, minus 16. The Russia-Ukraine war, Zelensky, Putin, Trump, minus 20. Tariffs, boom, minus 26. And this is the big takeaway on both of these measures, job approval and big issues. Inflation and cost of living, minus 32. That's a big, significant approval drop for the president. His plus numbers are 34 on that one. And his disapproval is 66%. All right. So if you remember the election last year, seems like so long ago. So long ago. What was the big?
Has it been 6 months? No. This would be 6 months.
Well, December. Well, most of November. Well, I mean, since taking office, yeah, 6 months.
Well, no. Not since.
Five months.
Said, like, it's been like, since the election. It's been six or 7 months. I'm bad with math today.
Me too. And I'm bad at math always, not just on the show. So if you remember the election, what were the big? The gas and groceries.
Yes.
And border policy / immigration / crime. Those are the big issues. I'll just go down the list. As of, this was early, when were the numbers? Survey, May 5th to May 15th. So pretty recent. What's the date today? 20th, 21st?
21st.
Okay. Pretty recent polling of Americans. The number one issue, and I'm not surprised by this, but this is important because I think it's going to measure the conduct, the actions, ultimately the tenure of this second term of Donald Trump. The number one issue for Americans, inflation and the cost of living. 36% of the entire sampling base. It almost doubles what's number two, which is threats to democracy, which is also a significant one. Well down the list are the things that we talked about during the November run-up. Immigration, border security, just 9% of this polling sample said it was the most important.
So this is what people are saying their most important issue is.
Right now or as of last week. And I think it's significant because it shows you what Americans are thinking. So much about elections are the commercials and the rallies and the pressers and the all of the hoopla related to our every 4 year cycle. But when you get down to the post-election, when you get down to the inauguration and the first few months, it's about the real things that matter to us. And I can guarantee you, and I believe in these numbers, that inflation, the cost of living, is driving this sense of polling, this sense of dissatisfaction with the President of the United States. What do you think?
Well, no, I also just don't think whoever the president is, the cost of living, I don't even mean inflation. The cost of living, if you look at any graph of what it costs to buy a house, rent, cars, all healthcare, all of the different childcare, all of the different things of what it costs over time as compared to what average wages are.
Yeah, way up.
It is totally out of whack. And that has nothing actually to do with just inflation. I mean, it doesn't have anything to do with just inflation. It is just the fact that things are getting more expensive and people's wages are not keeping up. And it has been like this for a while. So there is, until we increase minimum wage, you know, have some kind of, people don't like this, but have some, the gap between what CEOs make and their lowest earner is insane compared to what it used to be. And so there's like a huge part of the wealth inequality that is, I don't think whoever the president is actually was going to change that. And we're going to keep having these flip-flopping, I'm like voting for change elections because it is a core systematic problem.
And it's not just the president.
It's not just the president.
State level too, because states have roles in these things. You know, what they do with their workforce, how they supplement or augment people's incomes, whether that's, you know, sort of credits, tax credits or whatever it is, to help them with things like child care or job training or all the things that cost money. You are exactly right when you say they haven't kept up the wages. And that sort of goes back 20 years or more when companies decided it was always customer first. Well, companies decided 20 plus years ago, shareholders first. Once they made that decision, it was less about pensions. We've seen pensions go away. It was less about keeping the customers happy. What can we get away with? What can we trim? What can we cut? What can we do to our employees to not only keep them, but trim what they would say, the fats of what we have to pay our employees. Once that decision was made, it's hard to come back to that. Do we have to? Yes.
Yes, but it's all, I mean, this is, we have to go to break, but it's also the fact of like private equity, how private equity, like industry after industry after industry, they're just gobbling up companies and hollowing them out.
Yeah. And for cash.
For cash, for bottom yeah. line profit. And that is a bigger thing that doesn't actually reflect on the president, but the buck stops there. So that's why we come back to these numbers.
And I always remind people, greed and selfishness are not good attributes.
They're not. All right. Point taken.
That's a good warm up.
You said you were sharp today. You weren't kidding.
No, I'm ready for this show. She is Chris and I am Steve. Let's take a break. Back right after this.
What's that look for?
I was looking at jazz. This is some fiery music. I love it.
All right. Moving on.
Let's play the music for a while.
We're going to touch on this briefly, only because it is my alma mater.
Yeah. Well, say what it is.
Madison West. So Madison West students. So this is, if you don't know Madison well, there are four high schools. Now, you know, there's Middleton and stuff, but there's Madison East, there's Madison West, there's Memorial, which I think is now actually called Velar Phillips, and La Follette. I went to Madison West. It's down the street from Camp Randall, so very close to University of Wisconsin-Madison. And at least when I was there, I can attest, civically engaged.
Yeah, because where they live. Yeah,
where you live. I mean, there's a lot of professors who send their kids there. So this story does not surprise me at all. But Madison West students in the school's Civics Club have asked the Dane County Board to urge state lawmakers to lower the voting age to 16 for school board elections.
Right.
Now, this is a very, very, very long shot because we actually would have to change the state constitution for this to happen, which we all know it would have to be two consecutive legislative sessions and then it would go to a ballot or go to a referendum on the ballot. So this likely will not happen. But they got the idea from the Newark City Council, which did adopt that ordinance in January of 2024.
Mm-hmm.
And so, one, I applaud these high school students for being very engaged. I also do, and I don't think it's going to happen, so this is kind of a hypothetical conversation. But what do you think as far as the ability to vote? If you are in school and you are a civically engaged young person, the ability to vote for the people who are making decisions about your education.
No. Driving
and voting. A fast no?
Yeah, I mean, why the arbitrary age of 16? Because high school, how old are you when you start high school? Like 13?
14.
Or wouldn't they just, if they're well-educated and informed and they have parents who are, you know, professors, and wouldn't they be qualified to make the, because as we all know, kids are so mature now at 12, right? We give them full access to smartphones and all the internet and everything that's on there, including smut and everything else that they watch.
Smut.
Yeah. I mean, it's one of those, look, here's what I appreciate about this story. They actually care about things.
Yes.
I love that
they
about
want to be able to vote, right? When we have a lot of people who don't take advantage of their right to vote.
Absolutely.
I do want to applaud them for their engagement of saying, I want to be, have a voice in the decisions that affect my life.
I will give them praise. At the same time, I criticize people who never vote when they're 30, 40, 50, 60, whatever. I have much more praise for these young people than I do for those people. They're just those people that I'm talking
about. But you're also like, no, you're not going to be able to vote.
No. Because, one, it's a heavy lift. I mean, we're not changing.
In our state, it is a very heavy lift. But yeah. I just thought it was interesting. Because this goes back to the reason why we had the most recent Constitution Amendment referenda, which it was only citizens can vote.
Right.
Even though which is already the law.
Yeah, which was already the law. We're going to make it really clear.
Make it very, very clear. And so because there was other cities that were allowing people who are not citizens to vote in local elections.
Correct.
Because of local taxes and having a say in city council and like who the mayor is and school boards and stuff like that, but not voting in federal elections. And that's where that entire idea came from. So it was barring any city that ever went in Wisconsin that might go rogue and try to introduce that ordinance.
So because I'm a positive person, I want to say to the members of the Madison West Civics Club, I appreciate the thought and the effort that went into this. It shows them that you're engaged, and I look forward to seeing you vote when you're 18.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right. Well, go done. Regents.
Well done. Yeah.
That's point taken.
That's a good, absolutely point taken.
All right, but speaking of what you were saying as far as 12-year-olds with cell phones, those teen accounts that Instagram rolled out, not so friendly to teens. We'll talk more about that after this. Welcome back to Point Taken. Now, we have talked, we talk a fair amount about AI and social media and the impact both on kids, but also ourselves. We were just talking this morning that I am feeling this dilemma as of late that I have built, a sizable following on social media. That's kind of where I got my start. And this feeling, that's where I get a lot of my news, but also feeling the drain of what screens are doing to my brain, what social media is doing to my brain, and like, how do I put better boundaries up to decouple those things so I don't, like, my memory isn't crap like it's become, and all of these different things that I know it's because of how much time I spend on my phone. What we know even more is how bad this is for kids, right? And when we come back from the bottom of the other news, we're actually going to talk to Mark Sommerhauser from Wisconsin Policy Forum, who recently looked at what policies are going into place for high schools for banning phones or restricting phone access in schools.
Very big topic.
But on top of this, there's the access to the phone and there's the access to social media.
Mm-hmm.
And last year, or was it already 2 years ago, Meta, which owns both Facebook and Instagram, had said that they rolled out these teen accounts that were promising that they would automatically shield teens from harmful content. It turns out, didn't really do a good job doing that. So there is a new report by Accountable Tech and Design It For Us, which is a group of young advocates, and they did an experiment where they pretended to be teens. So they signed up under these teen accounts. And guess what? They were not protected from sensitive content. In fact, they were shown lots of it, including content of not eating, so you stay thin, sexual content, and body shaming content, a lot of it. And so one, shame on Meta for even pretending that they had solved any kind of problem. And also it just comes back to, is there any, like, when are we, my first reaction when I heard this is we hear so much about the types of groups like Moms for Liberty that are spending so much energy on libraries and banning books and getting these, not appropriate content out of school libraries. Where is that same, where did they have that same energy to go after Meta? Because I promise you, there is way more content being consumed on your kids' phones from these accounts or just any access to any porn site that's out there that you don't, you're like, are you 18? Sure. Versus what they're, the books are checking out from their school library. So it's like, where is this same energy to hold these companies accountable?
My simple answer to that question you just asked is because the folks like Zuckerberg and Bezos and Musk are now in the friendly camp. That is, they have endorsed conservative elected officials, including the President of the United States. So we don't want to, you know, rile their feathers at all. It is clearly the case that these, this access and whatever controls are, is not working.
It's not working.
And here's an example. I'm not a kid, but I'm an adult. So I only go on Twitter now to post my show content or share something from 620 WTMJ. Otherwise, I have no use for it because it's a place of trolls.
You're not spitting hot takes anymore?
Not anymore. I'll do that on the show. That's
you,
what
have,
this,
you have a platform. You have another space so you can do that.
Absolutely. And I also have podcasts. So I go on yesterday. I think I was sharing something about Salute to Service. And there's a For You and a Following. And this thing always flips to
For You.
For You. And then you know what happens on Twitter when you see the For You? It's all kinds of stuff that you're not necessarily wanting to see. Including my father who goes, God, there's a lot of porn on there now.
Your dad's on Twitter?
Yeah.
Wow.
Because he follows me.
Okay.
Yeah. Which is kind of cool. He's 89.
Yeah,
I think that's
great.
Awesome. But that's the reality.
Maybe it's great. I don't know.
There's no
depends on what he's clicking on.
So there's no to this point though. To this question, there's no control over any of this stuff. Wish we had more time. Let's dig into this
because we'll talk to Mark after this as far as what's possible as far as controlling school phones in schools. But I think there's a lot more to get to when it comes to this topic and when it comes to social media and how what we're shown. Day in and day out.
Yeah, so we got a shortened show today. We got early Brewers, which is exciting. I think they're on a 3-game winning streak. We got Mark Sommerhalder coming up next. Don't forget the last half hour, Salute to Service. Got a great one today. Local chaplain for many fire departments in our area and also pastors. Very cool stories. Thanks for tuning in on this Wednesday hump day edition of The Point Taken. It's Kristen Bryce, Steve's committee. We got a great conversation because we sort of cheated up in the last half hour at the end. Access. To everything when you talk about smartphones specifically. And joining us on the hotline here at WTMJ is Mark Sommerhalder, Communications Director at the Wisconsin Policy Forum. Good morning.
Good morning, Steve. It's good to be with you.
I love the fact that your organization is looking at this issue because I talk to a lot of parents in email and text and, you know, away from the show. And it's something that comes up a lot is the access to phones while in school, while sort of going through the educational process. You guys sort of did a research project on this, a study. Let's talk about some of the key findings, including maybe just start with what districts are doing and how many students are actually having that access to their cell phones.
Yeah, so thanks, Steve. So that piece of our research kind of centered on a survey that was recently conducted by the Wisconsin Department of Public Instruction. They sent out a survey asking about a lot of digital practices that districts have. One of their questions was, do you have any kind of policy around student cell phone use in schools and in the classroom? They did get pretty good response rate on this survey. More than 300 districts and independent charter schools did respond. So we got a decent picture, I think, from the survey of what districts are doing. And they really have quite a patchwork of policies. The vast majority of districts do have some sort of a policy restricting student cell phone use, but that can take different forms. So the most prevalent that we saw would be a restriction on students, basically banning students from being able to use their phones during instructional time. So those districts, they would allow students to bring their phones to school. They can have them in their lockers. In some cases, they can have them, you know, on their person throughout the school day. They just can't use them in the classroom during instructional time, but they would be able to use them, for instance, in a hallway, in a cafeteria, some sort of a common space within the school. So that does seem to be by far the most common policy that we do see districts adopting. There is a, you know, I would say a sizable minority of districts that are doing a complete ban on any use of phones during the school day. So that is something that some districts have. And then even smaller minority are still going with a sort of no blanket restriction approach. That doesn't mean that individual teachers or schools can't have restrictions, because in some of those districts that is the case. But they're just not imposing a blanket restriction at the district-wide level.
So what types of schools and districts appear to be going the more stringent way as far as restricting it or like a full ban?
Yeah, so one thing that we found, geographically, there was not as much of a pattern as we might have thought. It was kind of more scattered throughout the state. Where we did find some patterns were that smaller districts as well as charter schools did seem in general to have more stringent restrictions. We classified the districts and the schools into different brackets based on their total enrollment. And we did see among the smaller districts a greater share that had full bans. Also, we did find that when we broke it down by urbanization, so there's four categories that we did there, city or urban districts, suburban, town, and rural districts. We did see a larger share of city districts or urban districts with full bans. However, the caveat to that is that there seemed to be a real split among the urban districts between the public districts, which pretty much looked like the rest of the state, and the independent charter schools, many of which are located in urban areas of our state, including in Milwaukee, which did seem to have definitely more stringent requirements. Many of them had full bans on cell phone use.
You describe the current state of affairs as a patchwork sort of approach to this, some not allowing it, some allowing it, some variations between those two things. And you mentioned some of the reporting suggests the legislature is now looking at this. The attempt, I guess, the effort by the legislature would be, let's have one policy across the state, all schools, that says, here's what makes sense, here's what limits access, here's what, probably the most important piece of all of this, gives kids the best access to education, and perhaps a smartphone is a tool for that. I'm not an expert on it, but at least it has to have some guidelines. Is that what they're looking at?
Yeah, so under the bill that's been brought forward in the legislature, it actually has passed the state assembly, is still awaiting a vote in the state senate. It would essentially set a baseline. So, in other words, it would set a sort of minimum restriction on student cell phone use. Districts could go more stringent than this law if they wanted under the legislation. But it would essentially codify for all districts what the majority of districts are already doing, a policy that the majority of districts already have adopted, which is that students would be able to bring their cell phones. They would be able to use them in common areas of the school, but they would not be able to use them in the classrooms during instructional time under this legislation. And, we can talk a little more about this, but I should say it does align very closely with bills and laws that other states are taking up. We're really seeing a national conversation about this right now, and a lot of states either have adopted these kind of laws or are debating them right now. Iowa's governor just signed a law very similar to the one that's being the bill that's been proposed here in Wisconsin. In Illinois, Governor Pritzker is supporting a bill that is, again, very similar to the Wisconsin bill. So it really is a national movement and a national conversation that's happening.
We're talking to Mark Sommerhauser, who is the Communications Director for Wisconsin Policy Forum. And when we come back, I want to talk a little bit more about, one, enforcement, because it's one thing to have a rule. It's another thing to actually enforce the rule. And two, also the public opinion, because I know that there's a lot of parents in the age of school shootings who think it's really important for kids to have a phone on them in case of an emergency. So let's talk about both of those things when we come back on Point Taken. Welcome back to Point Taken. I am Kristen Bry. He is Steve Scafidi, and we are talking to Mark Sommerhauser, Communications Director for Wisconsin Policy Forum, about their recent research on Wisconsin joining the call for change on cell phones in schools. And so we have not passed any statewide legislation on what schools should be doing with phones. There's a lot of districts who do a lot of different things. But as we talk about where this is headed, Mark, what is the conversation? I don't know if you guys looked into this as far as enforcement, because I think maybe a full ban feels easier to enforce. But if the phone is in their pocket, is it... I know, was it Greenfield? There was a local district around Milwaukee that was talking about like getting police involved for enforcement. And I think that failed. But what's the conversation as far as, all right, we can have the rule, but how do we actually enforce the rule?
Yeah, so thanks. I mean, that was definitely something that we did look at a little bit, just because what we were hearing from individual districts, what DPI talked a little bit about in some of the material that it put out with this digital survey, is that imposing these restrictions on student cell phone usage while they're in schools and classrooms is one piece of things, but there are challenges around enforcement, particularly if you do have a policy, you know, where a student still has a phone in their pocket, in their purse, in their backpack. And so we are seeing more schools, in addition to imposing these restrictions on usage, they're putting additional restrictions in place around what sort of when and where a student can actually possess their phone. And so that can take a lot of different forms. So some districts, including one district we spoke to the superintendent of, are doing an approach where they're only permitting students to keep phones in their locker so they can bring their school phone into school at the beginning of the day, but they put it in their locker. It stays in there throughout the day. If they're in the hallway, they can, you know, they can access the phone there at their locker, but otherwise it's not with them. One thing that more districts are doing is using these sealable pouches. You might have seen these if you go to like a concert or a show somewhere. So that's actually something that's becoming a little more prevalent, that the students will be required to use those pouches to put their phones in there. Others are doing something a little simpler where the students are just required to put their phone. The teacher will have like a caddy or a basket on his or her desk, and the students will be asked to put their phones in the basket at the start of class. They can pull them out at the end of class. So there's different approaches that we see happening, but they're all kind of centered around the fact that while districts may see some benefit in these usage restrictions, it can also be a challenge for teachers to enforce, and that's where some of these other restrictions might come into play.
It's sort of a general question, but content, sort of the supervision of content, does that ever come into play, or is it basically just access in these bigger, broader conversations?
Yeah, I think that's a good question. That's not something we were able to delve into just because we didn't really have data on it like we had the data from DPI on the usage restrictions. But I think that's another piece of it in terms of, you know, not just the usage, but what are students actually potentially accessing in school on their phones? It's a good question, and it's something that we might delve into in a future report.
Mark, we only have about a minute left, but as far as outside of schools, what is the public opinion? What are parents actually saying when it comes to wanting this or still wanting their kids to have a phone on them in case of an emergency?
Yeah, so in our report, we reference a survey that was done last year by Pew Research, which is a pretty widely respected organization. They did a survey with a really large sample, and they found pretty broad support for more than two-thirds of U.S. adults said they support banning middle and high school students from using cell phones during class. So that's basically very, you know, mirrors what the legislation here in Wisconsin would ban. And interestingly, they did not find very much difference at all between adults who were parents and those who were not. A slightly smaller share of parents were in favor of these restrictions, but it was still close to two-thirds that did favor them. So pretty broad support for that kind of a restriction. When you move into the full ban on any sort of cell phone use anywhere in a school building, we do see somewhat of a drop-off in the public support. And so it does suggest that maybe there is a little bit of a sweet spot within public opinion for saying that, you know, students perhaps should be permitted to bring these phones into school, but they shouldn't be permitted to use them during class time.
Great stuff. Mark Sommerhauser, Communications Director, Wisconsin Policy Forum. Let's talk down the line. I'm sure there's a lot more develops on this story and others that will bend your ear on over the next months and years ahead. Thanks, Mark.
Thanks, Mark.
Always good to be with you. Thank you.
Hey, real quick, I did look up Greenfield. They don't use police enforcement, but they have very strict regulations.
No, because it failed. But there was a conversation around it. I remember there was as far as getting police involved, and there's a lot of people who are like, what?
Yeah, but they have very strict rules. They prohibit the use of cell phones, other personal electronic devices during instructional time, i.e. one in class. So that's an example of pretty strict rules. All right, after the break, a mini version of Ask Us Anything.
Single segment.
Yeah, we'll ask each other questions.
Okay.
How about that? That's next.
Or Ask Us Anything on Point Taken. Got a burning question? Give us a call or text on the Siding Unlimited Talk and Text line.
No, not really.
855-616-1620.
Good thought, though.
We got 3 minutes. We got 3 minutes for a very, very short Ask Us Anything. And so we figured maybe we would ask each other something.
Yeah, I got mine.
All right, you want to go first?
Tied into our last conversation. At what age would you give your child, or children if you have more than one, access to a cell phone?
I think Mike and I are on the point, I mean, granted, Frankie's 20 months, right. So who knows what the world would look like 10 years from now. It's one of those things where I feel like you think you're not going to give your kid, have the TV on. You're like, oh, I would be the perfect parent.
I'm not going to be that.
And then the pressure comes in. Yeah. So this is, ideally what we are on the same page as now, and this is no shame to parents who buckle under the pressure and do it earlier. I'm a big fan of you can get a flip phone, like middle school into high school, so you can have access to calling and getting a hold of us and us getting a hold of you. I think a smartphone, oh, God, if we could hold off until sophomore or junior year, that would be awesome. Ideally, the later, the better.
Did you say sophomore or junior year of high school?
Yeah.
You know what the average for?
It's like 11. Smart,
11. Good, good. You must be doing your homework.
But it's also, like, I hear this from other parents, is it's one thing to say that's what we're going to do. It's another thing that once all your kids' friends have phones, or one of our teammates, Selena, her daughter's friends have older siblings. So the idea that the older siblings have phones, and then the younger kids want phones, and the friends of the younger friends want phones. And so it's just like that pressure. And so it's one of those things where you kind of have to have a collective decision as a community of, like, we are holding off. So it's not like the peer pressure that one kid has it and one kid's getting left out of all the conversation.
And if you talk about some of the generational differences between your generation and my generation, we didn't even have to think about this.
I know. See, I had a Nokia brick phone in high school.
I had one of those for work.
Where I played Snake.
Yeah, those things.
And that was kind of the... I also heard something interesting the other day, and then I want to ask you my question, about, like, just emotional intelligence and, like, having to sit with your feelings and how... For, like, Gen X and older, and, like, a little bit of millennials, like, you didn't have the distraction in your pocket all the time of, like, having to think about your stuff, having to think about what was on your mind. Like, immediately, whether it's social media or a game on your phone or scrolling the news, like, the avoidance of being able to not sit with what's going on with you and find something else to focus on is constant. All right, my question for you is, are there any words or mottos that you live by?
Try to do the right thing. My dad told me that a long time ago.
All right, so that's what kind of is in your head all the time?
Always try to do the right thing. I'm trying to think of other words or mottos. Honesty is important, obviously. You know, I'm not perfect. I was a jerk when I was a young kid. And,
were you?
And young, yeah, I mean...
Cocky? Were you cocky?
No, I just...
What do you mean by jerk then?
I wasn't thoughtful. I wasn't necessarily nice to everyone. Okay. You know, just a young adolescent... Maybe a little bit cocky just from, the way that young men can be cocky in their college years. But I wasn't mean to anybody or anything like that. I didn't get in fist fights all the time.
So then what you mean? How are you a jerk if you weren't mean to anyone?
I don't think I appreciated other people's commentary or thoughts or feelings.
But you do now.
I do now, yeah. So that hopefully that's an improvement over the last however many years that is, which is a lot of them, more than you've been alive. It's a good question, though.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I just know if there's like a... thing that rings true.
You know what's coming up after the break?
Salute to service.
Yes, we got a great story today. A local pastor and a fire department chaplain for many departments, and an awesome, as is always the case, an awesome nomination. Those folks are going to be in here in studio after the news.
Hearing the stories and recognizing the heroes in our lives that continue to make a difference. This is Steve Scafidi's Salute to Service, presented by Waterstone Bank. Here's Steve Scafidi and Kristen Bry.
And every day this week, we are honoring some of those first responders. It's a rare week because we have six, actually. We have co-honorees on Thursday's program. We got a good one today. All of these stories are vastly different, and they're all touching different pieces of the story, the great story that is the first responder legacy, right? The things they do every day for all of us who some of these things go unreported. Some are reported, not necessarily in the nicest way, but this is a positive story, and today is a really good one. We are joined in studio by the nominator. She is Christy Yadamio, who nominated her husband, Mark, who's also in studio here, who's not only a chaplain, but also a pastor, and your co-pastors at Norway Lutheran Church in Wind Lake. Welcome to the studio.
Thank you.
So I'm going to start with you, Christy, because you started the process. You nominated Mark, who I've read what he does for a lot of different districts. I've read some of the things he does in his role as a faith leader. Why did you nominate him?
Because there's nobody better.
You're obviously biased.
I am a little biased, but I've been working side by side with him at the church for 20 years plus now. So we do a lot of things together, but the firefighter chaplaincy, he does all on his own. You know, I watch that one from afar, and I'm impressed every day at the commitment he gives, the time he gives to the ladies and gentlemen that he helps, and just the fantastic work ethic he has to help people.
I'm going
to
ask him the same question, but when you know him as a pastor,
yes,
and you said you let him sort of do his chaplaincy, how do some of the things that he does as pastor or co-pastor in this case sort of translate to that, do you think?
Well, the love of people is an immediate transfer. I mean, both of us care a lot about the people we serve at Norway Lutheran Church and have served at other churches. And I think that it easily translates into the community. We care about the community folks, too. And when they came to him and said, we need a chaplain for the volunteer fire service then, it was Wind Lake Volunteer Firefighter Service then.
So, Mark, for people who maybe are unfamiliar, what does a chaplain for a fire department actually do?
That's a great question. Funny story, just a little brief one. When the chief came to me back in 2011, he asked, he goes, would you be our chaplain? And I asked him specifically, well, what does that mean? He looked at me and said, I have no idea.
I just know that we need one.
We need one because that's what they tell us we need.
And I'm honest, like, answer.
That's right. That's right. And so it really was a learning process. And what I learned was that the first and foremost, to be a chaplain, I do the official acts. I do debriefings and defusings. Those are events that come up after major events, suicides, killings, deaths, those kind of things. And it's an assessment. It's to make sure that the first responders, and that includes not only my fire, medics, EMTs, but it also includes the sheriff's department, police department, the hospital personnel, all of them, we have to make sure that they're okay. We have to make sure, and that's what a defusing is. It's the immediately after the event to make sure that they're stable.
It's not just Norway Fire Department either. You touch a lot of different departments. Just run through that list.
All of the departments that are west of 94. So I have Norway, Waterford, Wind Lake, Tishigan. I have everything from Caledonia to Test Corners to Union Grove, Burlington, and all that's the fire departments. And then you include in there all the sheriff's departments, as well as all of the police departments for all the different municipalities.
Unbiased again, everybody loves him. Once you meet him and work with him, they want to come back.
I can tell you that I know a bunch of police chaplains, including the one in Oak Creek, and they are well loved and appreciated. So, again, the question I asked Christy, so what translates? And I kind of know the answer, but from your role as co-pastor to your role as chaplain.
It's not hard at all. To be a pastor in our tradition, and I think, well, now I won't even say that. To be a pastor as we see it, you have to love people. Mm-hmm. All of them, their warts, their beautiful marks, everything, because it gives you a chance to not only begin to see, we're obviously Christian pastors, just to let everybody know. And so I believe that every single person created by God is a beautiful expression. I get to meet them. I get to talk to them. I get to see them. So it's not something that's a burden. It's a blessing. With that understanding, that's how we do our ministry. We look at our church. We look at the people that come in. Whether you're a member or not, I don't care. I get to meet you. I get to be with you. And so that passion and I guess that love is what allowed me to be a chaplain. To be very, very honest, the reason I initially started this is I wanted to drive fire trucks. I wanted to drive ambulances.
You and every three-year-old toddler.
That's true.
And not only that, they dress you up.
Oh, yeah.
And so you get to wear the good stuff.
Yeah.
And so the first time they stuck me behind... They're training me, obviously. First time they stuck me behind the engine, they're like, go ahead, put on the lights. And I'm like, yay, that's excellent. That's how it started, Steve, just again, to be honest.
That's a great, I love the honesty.
Yeah, and I love the humor that you've brought to it as well. We can take a break here, but I want to get to, there are difficult days in this position. And I want to talk a little bit about your role in some of those conversations. Not specific, but generally. We are joined by our third honoree. Here's what we're going to do. We're going to play the feature after the break because we sort of had so much fun talking. We're going to play the feature after the break, and then we're going to come back and ask him a lot more questions. Our third honoree is Mark Jaramillo and his lovely wife, Christy, who nominated him. Quick break, feature. We'll play it right out of the break, and then we'll get to our questions. This is a good one. I'm enjoying the heck out of this day. All right, quick break.
Hello, this is Aaron Lipsky, Milwaukee Fire Department. You are listening to Steve Scafidi's Salute to Service.
Hi, I'm Christy Jaramillo. I'm nominating my husband, Mark Jaramillo, for the Salute to Service.
Hi, I'm Mark Jaramillo. I am the chaplain with the Norway Fire Department.
I think he's one of the most giving people I've ever known in my life.
I've actually been a pastor coming up on 30 years, and very proud that 27 of those years have actually been with my wife as colleagues. And this absolutely shapes everything that I am, do, and how I even relate to this world.
He is always going. He's always trying to find the next way, the better way to help people. And once he connected with the firefighter community out here, he just knew that he had to connect in the full capacity.
If I'm going to be a pastor, if I'm going to be anybody, I have to be authentic. And because of that, I've always looked at what can I do to make a difference. 2011, I was approached by the chief of Norway Fire Department, and he looked at me and said, "Do you want to be a chaplain?" I looked at him and I went, "Well, what the heck does that mean?" He goes, "I don't know, but we'll figure it out together." And at that point, I had a pretty amazing experience just getting to be part of the department, but I quickly learned that for first responders, if you really truly want to be a part of their world, and if you want them to be able to trust you, you have to be one of them.
So he did all the training.
I ended up getting my certification as a firefighter, and then shortly after that, I became an EMT. And that was probably the best gift I could give to myself. Not only did I learn new skills, but it allowed me to really walk with people, particularly our first responders and all the stuff they have to deal with.
Been a little crazy around here to juggle everything.
I work with not only Norway Fire Department, but I have Waterford, Tishigan, Burlington, and all of those departments, as well as the sheriffs and police departments, have consistently sent me people to help, or people to talk to, or people who just want to have a person to reflect with.
The things he can do in a conversation now, he can help people tell their stories in a way that can help them get through it, whatever it is.
It's enhanced everything. And I can say that because my job as a pastor is to bring a real experience of life, but I have to bring it in a very real context, real way, in a real world with very real eyes. I don't wear rosy-colored glasses. As a leader, I have to live the life that I keep asking them to live, which is a life that's fruitful, productive, as well as loving. It doesn't surprise me when maybe 2 or 3 months after I've helped them dealing with a stroke or some kind of crisis, they show up at my church and they're like, "I know you."
What does salute to service mean to you?
I'm humbled. Brother, I'm a grunt. Whenever I heard from my wife that this was an honor given to me, I'm like, come on. I see our sheriffs, our police, our dispatchers, our hospital employees. I see what they go through, and I can tell you, these are amazing people. The medics, the EMTs, all of them. Their love and commitment to this community transcends any kind of award that I could see. So for me to get this, good Lord, I don't know. I can't believe I got it. I'll stop there.
That is a good place to stop. And I asked you about the connection between pastor and chaplain, and it's pretty evident that you understand that those things sort of match and come together. Our third Salute to Service honoree this week is Mark Jaramillo. He's joined by his nominator, his wife, Christy. That's not an easy job. And I don't want to just gloss over, because you're a fun guy and you're obviously an incredible communicator, which I appreciate as someone who does what I do and what Kristen does. But you have difficult conversations. And I would imagine, again, that the faith plays a role in that. You're a chaplain for a reason, because you have that infrastructure, that basis for having those conversations. When you have those difficult conversations, I imagine it all comes into play.
It does, particularly the faith element. But to be a chaplain, you have to be cognizant that not everybody follows the same line of faith, the same approach, whether it's being a Christian or not, or even looking at those who are Jewish or Muslim. You have to be aware of that. So being a chaplain, you have to be able to walk with people where they're at. And the faith element comes in when they bring it. It's not my job as a chaplain to evangelize. It is my job to be there in the way they need, so that it's, again, for them, an honest reflection of what they're dealing with. They're first responders. All of them, including myself, have consistently seen things that no human being wants to see.
And real quick, not just that commitment to your job, but one of the things that was mentioned in the piece and that Christy mentioned her nomination. Obviously a pastor, chaplain, trained as a firefighter, mm-hmm. trained as an EMT, and I believe also a licensed therapist.
Yeah, he graduated last Sunday.
That's what I was saying when we first interviewed you, yes. that you also, like, so lifelong learner, this one over
yeah.
here.
Yeah, absolutely. Age is not a barrier to education, and Mark Jaramillo is a tremendous example of that. We asked you in the piece what Salute to Service means to you. I'll ask Christy as we sort of wrap it up. What do you think it means?
Salute to Service is a wonderful way to say thank you. I mean, there's so many people over the years that he's helped. And I think this is one way for all of us to say thank you for what you do.
Incredibly well said. And I've made this point every day on the 3 days of Waterstone Banks and WTMJ Salute to Service. How you write a nomination matters. And the ones that we eventually pick are the ones that stand out because of what the nominator says about the person. The person, we know they're all amazing because they're all first mm-hmm. responders in their own different ways. And we have incredible people that get nominated that I can't pick, and I wish I could. And I try to reach out to all those people. But thank you for the great nomination, Christy. And Mark, keep up the good work. I mean, just that is you talk about a life well served. You are demonstrating that each and every day. And the commitment to your education, the commitment to your work in the faith community is absolutely first and foremost, impressive. So thank you for the work that you do as a first responder.
Absolutely.
We are doing this because of the great folks at Waterstone Bank. We have a bunch of gifts for you that we will mail to you. They're gift certificates from the Packing House and Botanas and some of our other great partners. The Aaron Waters Show. You get to go to the Aaron Waters Show and see the Blue Angels.
How about that?
Awesome.
So all of those great things are a small reward for your great service. But I want to thank you both for being here for our Salute to Service.
Thank you.
We'll take a quick break and wrap up the show on WTMJ. Quit your show today, but thanks to Pastor Mark Jaramillo and his lovely wife, Christy, who wrote an incredible nomination. And Mark, you can see why the guy, he's just impressive.
Impressive. He's someone you want to be around.
Yeah, he's fun and funny and smart and boy, he's good at his job. And he became highly recommended from some of the people that he's come across that I happen to also know. So that's 3 of 6. We have a double honorees tomorrow. Co-honorees.
Double whammy.
Yeah, which is a very good story. It's one of those life-saving stories. So we have a firefighter from Milwaukee, and we have the individual who rescued him, one of his peers, and then the chief, Aaron Lipsky of Milwaukee Fire Department, who is always a good conversation.
All three will be here?
Yeah, so we're going to have all the seats filled for our Salute to Service, which will be back at its regular time at 11:30 tomorrow. I really enjoyed the show today. I thought we covered a lot of stuff in a shorter show.
We did.
Yeah, I mean, some information about what the president's doing. As I watched, the president is meeting with South African president in the Oval Office, the well decked out Oval Office. He's certainly added a lot of gold. Look at the gold in there now. What do you think those trophies are on the mantle? What are those about? Golf trophies?
No.
No?
I have no idea.
A lot of press in there. They've jammed up. And is that Elon Musk I see in the background? How about that?
Elon. Is it? Oh, he's still there.
Yeah,
he's still there. Well, I mean, that is his home country. We have not dug into this at all as far as the refugee status for the, 49 white Afrikaners.
He found room for the 49.
And just, this is probably what I'll spend my afternoon doing, is digging into this more. Because the chyron for CNN is South African president meets with Trump as relations sour. Mm. So digging a little bit deeper into that and talking about it tomorrow.
Yeah, and then tomorrow we have Jeremy Janine talking about local stuff as well. So
we're also going to have Dr. Keekley, who's a urologist, who's going to join us to talk a little bit more about pancreatic cancer and what diagnoses usually look like, especially for older gentlemen, and what that means. So not more health than politics, but as we usually say, politics affect everything.
Yeah, certainly we've talked about that.